Hello and welcome to Science World. This past Wednesday, a U.S.-based company launched the first commercial observation satellite that will provide us with much higher definition images of the Earth than before. We've been hearing about the health benefits that chocolate provides. Today, we'll have a report on the kind of chocolate that will provide most of its advantages without the health-related problems that sugar-sweetened chocolate can cause. And we'll feature a couple of stories today regarding the deadly Ebola outbreak in West Africa, what's being done to end the scourge and help those already infected with the virus. The medical and science communities are ramping up efforts to develop and produce vaccines and treatments. Today, we'll talk with a scientist who, with his colleagues, is taking a unique new approach in coming up with a new Ebola vaccine. These stories and more are coming up for you on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. This past Wednesday, a U.S.-based company launched the first commercial observation satellite with twice better resolution than before. Science World's Doug Bernard has more.
An Atlas V rocket carrying Digital Globe's WorldView 3 high-resolution imaging satellite was successfully launched on Wednesday at 18:30 UTC by the United Launch Alliance from California's Vandenberg Air Force Base. The launch, which marked the first commercial Atlas mission to fly out of Vandenberg, came 2 months after the U.S. government relaxed its restrictions on the resolution of commercial satellite imagery from 50 to 25 centimeters. Images from the company's previously launched satellites are being used by many private companies and agencies, such as Microsoft, NASA, and the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. Google is using them for its popular Google Earth, Google Maps, and Street View services. Digital Globe says the new twice-as-sharp images from WorldView 3, which will be available starting early in 2015, will make it possible to see objects as small as 25 centimeters. Previously, photographing such high-resolution imagery for commercial purposes required hiring specially equipped aircraft. Satellite imagery is increasingly being used in mapping, natural resource research, urban planning, navigation, and many other areas. For Science World, I'm Doug Bernard.
Some people just can't get enough chocolate. But while nutritionists warn that the sugar in chocolate is bad for us, doctors point to the beneficial qualities of its antioxidants. George Putich tells us about a type of chocolate that just might be good for us.
The biggest benefit from eating cocoa and dark chocolate may be lowered blood pressure, thanks to the almost decadent feeling of cocoa butter melting in your mouth. That mood may also contribute to chocolate's antidepressant qualities, says dietitian Kim Hoffman.
It contains phenethylamines, which is a neurotransmitter that's found in the brain and actually acts as a mood elevator. It also enhances the blood endorphins, which are the happy opiates. And they are basically around when you're on a high.
Not all chocolate is equal when it comes to those beneficial chemicals. Some researchers say the high heat required to process commercial chocolate up to 130 degrees centigrade can actually lower their effectiveness. At Honest Chocolate in Cape Town, South Africa, artisan chocolatier Anthony Grid keeps the temperature of his raw chocolate below 42 degrees.
There's a movement to minimal cooking or minimal heating of food just to retain the natural antioxidants or whatever, the minerals, whatever it may be. So cocoa is part of that. You can do it raw with a very good quality bean.
In order to reduce cocoa's natural bitterness, manufacturers of chocolate products remove polyphenols, antioxidants that create the bitter taste, and add sugar. Food science writer Leonie Joubert notes that sugar is connected to weight-related illnesses and that chocolate isn't something that should be eaten every day.
The problem is that overexposure to sugar over a long period of time, it causes this repeated inflammatory response in the body, which now is linked to heart disease, Obviously, it's linked to obesity and weight problems and the associated diseases.
The confections at Honest Chocolate are made with agave nectar rather than cane sugar and have a very high percentage of cacao, something customer Jessica Bonin appreciates.
What I find quite remarkable about their chocolate is that you're not overwhelmed by the sugar, so you actually get to taste the chocolate itself, which is really so luxurious and quite decadent.
Like many other chocolate connoisseurs, Bonin satisfies her craving with just one small piece of really good chocolate. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Speaking of chocolate, what nation, according to a survey published in the trade journal ConfectionaryNews.com, consumes the most chocolate per person in the world? Is it A, the United States, B, Germany, C, Switzerland, or D, China? Think about it. Good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
While oceans seem to harbor an inexhaustible supply of food, we humans have done a lot over the years to harm this valuable resource. Roseanne Skirbel tells us about a new book that discusses the oceans and our relationship with them.
The Extreme Life of the Sea engages readers in the drama and conflict of life in the ocean.
By looking at the extremes of what life can do, we can sort of surmise what it is capable of in large.
Tony Palumbi and his father, Steve, a marine scientist at Stanford University, focus on creatures that survive in that extreme world.
They're constantly eating one another and competing with one another and trying to swim through a really dense medium and then have crashing waves or incredible heat or incredible cold. So those extremes are really outside our normal experience, but the ocean is full of life. Has the most diversity on the planet, millions of species. Every corner of the ocean has got thriving life in it.
20 million years ago, the giant megalodon shark ruled the ocean. Steve Palumbi points to the dagger-like teeth in the enormous 2-meter-wide jaw.
How do you grow something that's 3 times sharper than a razor blade? And they not only grow them, but they grow lots of them because as they get dull, they just discard them. So they grow rows of teeth in their throat, and then they come out, and those are the biting teeth.
The oldest known creature on the planet is a deep-sea black coral in Hawaii that was alive more than 4,200 years ago when the pyramids of Egypt were being built. And one of the fastest, says Steve Palumbi, is the sailfish, which races after prey at speeds greater than 60 kilometers per hour. A survivor in extreme cold is the blackfin icefish that lives in Antarctica. It's developed an antifreeze protein to keep its blood from freezing. And Steve Palumbi says the Pompeii worm lives in both extreme heat and cold at the same time in a hydrothermal sea vent. These curious critters are but a sampling of the ocean's denizens, whose diversity remains largely unexplored and whose habitat is under assault from overfishing, pollution, and climate change. The oceans will always be alive, Tony Palumbi says. It's a question of what's in them.
So we're looking at the potential of a future where the oceans are filled with algae rafts and massive amounts of jellyfish and sea cucumbers and the sorts of squishy, scummy things that, while perfectly valid forms of organic life on planet Earth, are not the sorts of things that we like.
The oceans can thrive. One solution is to expand marine sanctuaries that limit human activity. What's missing, Steve Palumbi says, is the political will to take action. That can change, he adds, with engaged and concerned citizens. The future of the ocean, the authors say, rests in our hands, and we must become better stewards to protect it and ourselves. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
The Ebola virus that has killed more than 1,000 people in West Africa also is taking a devastating toll on wildlife, including the critically endangered western lowland gorilla. Steve Barragona tells us more in this report.
One day in 1996, boys from a village in northern Gabon brought home a chimpanzee they found dead in the forest. The villagers butchered it for food and set off an Ebola outbreak that killed 21 people, according to the World Health Organization. Years later, on a reporting trip in Gabon, author David Quammen met two men from that village who were there during the outbreak. They said their families were not the only ones affected. He spoke to VOA via Skype.
At the time Ebola was hitting their village, they saw something strange. Nearby in the forest, they saw a pile of 13 dead gorillas.
Ebola had killed them, too. For the Western Lowland gorilla, Quammen says, Ebola has been devastating.
There has been an epidemic wave of death passing through gorilla populations across Central Africa, a wave of Ebola that has been killing them as well as occasionally killing humans.
University of Cambridge ecologist Peter Walsh was studying groups of gorillas in a Congolese sanctuary in the early 2000s when two Ebola outbreaks struck. 90 to 95% of the gorillas simply disappeared. In a Skype interview, Walsh said he and his colleagues estimated that Ebola would wipe out 45% of the entire population in just one generation.
The combination of particularly bushmeat hunting and disease was really slamming Western gorillas.
He co-authored a scientific assessment that put the Western Lowland gorilla on the critically endangered list. For David Quammen, the story of the 13 dead gorillas outside the Gabonese village shows how new infections are connecting humans and animals. In his book, Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic, he describes the growing pace at which these diseases are jumping from animals to people. It's not new. Bubonic plague, for example, jumped from rodents to humans through infected fleas. It killed as much as 60% of Europe in the 14th century. But David Quammen says the rate of spillover seems to be increasing.
Something seems to be different because we've seen a lot of these new diseases, especially viral diseases, emerging over the last 5 or 6 decades. And that, of course, raises the question of why? What's different now?
One answer, Quammen says, is the growing human population is encroaching deeper and deeper into new habitats and encountering new creatures.
There are now 7 billion of us on the planet. We're going into these diverse ecosystems. We're cutting down trees. We're building mines. We're building villages and roads. And we're coming in contact with these animals. We're giving the viruses that those animals carry the opportunity to jump to a new host, to spill over into human populations.
Spillover goes in the other direction, too. Peter Walsh says ecotourism has been great for conserving wild ape habitat, but he adds those tourists are unwittingly killing the apes they come to see.
Human respiratory viruses are the number one source of death in habituated chimpanzees and gorillas. In chimpanzees, it's half of the deaths are caused by human respiratory viruses.
Walsh advocates vaccinating apes that come in contact with tourists against human diseases such as measles. He and his colleagues are also calling for better enforcement of the laws against hunting the critically endangered Western Lowland gorilla. But the gorillas will remain vulnerable to a disease taking a toll on both humans and our wild relatives. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
It's time to find out if you have the correct answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. Earlier, we asked, what nation, according to a survey published in the trade journal ConfectionaryNews.com, consumes the most chocolate per person in the world? Is it A, the United States, B, Germany, C, Switzerland, or D, China? The answer is C, the people of Switzerland. According to the survey, the Swiss really love their chocolate, with each person consuming an average of 11.9 kilograms of the delicious confection each year. All but one of the top 10 highest chocolate-consuming nations are located in Europe. The U.S., by the way, is way down in 15th place, with each American eating or drinking about 5.5 kilograms each year. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
Gitto van der Groen, who discovered the Ebola virus in 1976, says that conditions that exist now in West Africa are more favorable when it comes to testing experimental drugs that could help fight Ebola than when he first began studying the virus. Pam Dawkins has the story.
Gitto van der Groen says he's not surprised by the extent of the ongoing Ebola outbreak, which has resulted in more than 1,000 deaths in West Africa since February. The former head of the virology unit at Belgium's Institute of Tropical Medicine says Africa is a different place now from when he first studied Ebola more than 30 years ago in what was then Zaire.
When we started to find the virus for the first time, the areas in which we find this virus was the northern part of Zaire, which was really a rural area and which was not densely populated. And in these days, mobility of the people were very, very, very low compared to now.
Van der Groen says while Africa's population density has contributed to the spread of the virus, it could also benefit researchers considering experimental treatments.
On a daily basis, you still have a decent number of new infections. So that means that a number of patients which you can follow, if you have a chance to start to treat some of them, you will learn in a very, very short period if some of these promising products indeed are beneficial.
Van der Groen is now retired, but says he has a lot of correspondence with teams that are working on experimental drugs. One drug under development is a vaccine that contains the strain of Ebola that is currently spreading in West Africa. The drug, which is based on the human rabies vaccine, is being developed by Matthias Schnell, the director of the Vaccine Center at Jefferson Medical College in Philadelphia.
Currently, the plan are to perform probably the first human trial with that vaccine in 2 to 3 years, but depending on funding, we could do it earlier.
Another experimental drug, ZMapp, is being used to treat several people who are infected with Ebola in West Africa. Thomas Geisbert is a professor of microbiology and immunology at the University of Texas Medical Branch. He says any decision to use experimental Ebola drugs on a wider scale would be complicated.
I think it's a very complicated question. I think it's complex, and I think it's probably a question that's best left to the regulatory groups.
He also says pharmaceutical companies have been slow to develop potential drugs that could help fight or prevent Ebola because there is a small global market for the products. He says on the global scale, Ebola cases are relatively low when compared to conditions such as malaria, influenza, or cancer. The current outbreak in 4 West African countries has affected just under 2,000 people, although the number of cases continues to grow on a daily basis. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, Washington.
As you just heard in Pam Dawkins' report, scientists, medical laboratories, and pharmaceutical companies all over the world are scrambling to develop vaccines that protect people from acquiring the Ebola virus and treatments for those already infected with this deadly disease. Scientists at the Georgia State University are also hard at work developing an Ebola vaccine, except rather than use the methods that have long been used in the development of vaccines, they've chosen to take a different route in producing what they hope will be an effective Ebola vaccine. Dr. George Pierce, a microbiologist and professor of microbiology at Georgia State, is one of the scientists working on this research project. He joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about what he and his colleagues are doing in the fight to wipe out Ebola and what makes their approach in developing the vaccine so unique. Dr. Pierce, you and your colleagues are working to develop a vaccine for the Ebola virus. Just so we can be clear, what you're working on is something that will help protect those who never got the Ebola virus from the disease, and it's not a cure for someone that's infected with the virus.
That's the premise that we're operating on now. I have to qualify it because what people have found, for example, and with research with HIV, with many of the viruses that they first were developing for prophylactic use, they've turned out to be of value for therapeutic use. So at present, I can't say how it would work therapeutically, but certainly the reason we started the program in the beginning was for a prophylactic vaccine.
And I understand that you and your colleagues are taking an alternative route in researching and developing the vaccine that's quite different from the way traditional vaccines are produced. Before we get into these new methods, can you explain how vaccines are usually produced?
In the classic system, you would grow up a microorganism, and you could either kill the organism or attenuate that organism. So in the past, for example, with pertussis, the organism was grown up and then was chemically inactivated, and then they used some of the molecules derived from that inactivated organism to raise immunology. And again, that's a time-honored approach. It probably goes back, well, to the 1790s and smallpox. At least that's when it was recorded. It was used much earlier. But that approach goes back easily 200 years, and it's relatively easy to do. In the case of Ebola, that approach did not work.
Can you explain the technique, the alternative technique that you and your colleagues are using to research and develop the vaccine?
The technique we're looking at, a number of others have used it, like a vaccinate in New Jersey, Stephen Mizell at Wake Forest, just to name a couple. It basically is called a fusion protein. And what the principle there is, you take a weakly immunogenic protein and link it with another protein. In this case, we're linking it with a protein that's used to make up the motive unit in a bacteria, a flagellum. Proteins linked to flagellum develop a much higher adaptive immune response.
Dr. Pierce, I understand that rather than working with the Ebola virus itself, you're working with something called the Marburg virus. Why work on the Marburg virus and not the Ebola virus directly?
It's one of timing. When we started this program, people had and just discovered, if you will, the group up at USAMR with Sina Bavari had discovered that the glycoproteins in Ebola, these were huge, huge proteins, way too big to express in a bacterium. A separate group, Kalina, had actually identified in Marburg, which is very closely related to Ebola, the sister glycoprotein, and identified the small amino acid region that was responsible for raising the immune response. Also, that group at Kalina had showed that small protein, 15 amino acids, when administered to mice, would protect those mice against Marburg. So the tack there was to take that small protein, express it in bacteria as a fusion protein, and then test it for Marburg, and then also test it for Ebola. The reason we did that, because Vaccinate and others, when they were developing this same technology for seasonal flu, found that the seasonal flu vaccine was actually effective for other variants of the influenza, not just the one they made it for.
This alternative technique you're using, one of the advantages, should this work and should the development come along as you're hoping, that it will result in the ability to produce the vaccine faster and in larger volumes. How so?
Well, because it's expressed in a bacterium, and we know, for example, the bulk of insulin used today in the United States is recombinant insulin produced in the bacteria. And that bacteria produces genuine, authentic human insulin in high purity, high quantity. We're using that same technique that people have looked at for years to grow up bacteria at very high densities and then have that organism express a very specific protein. So we know that we can grow up very large amounts of bacteria in 2-3 days, and then it takes about 2 weeks of processing to get that material to FDA standard. And that's part of the approach why, for example, companies like Vaccinate looked at this approach for influenza, because typically if you're using embryonated eggs to make the vaccine, you're talking months. And here now you're talking about the whole process can be done in a fraction of the time. I really firmly believe at the end of the day we are going to conquer this problem.
That was Dr. George Pierce, a microbiologist and professor of microbiology at Georgia State University, located in Atlanta, Georgia. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the Internet. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.